Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Before leaving office, Barack Obama commuted the sentences of more than 1,700 prison inmates, more than any other U.S. president. Most of the commutations were for nonviolent drug offenders serving mandatory minimum sentences. This second chance approach was compounded by the Department of Justice, which in November announced a raft of criminal justice reform initiatives. And that interests author Piper Kerman, whose 13-month stint in a federal prison was the basis for her groundbreaking memoir, Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison, and the hit Netflix series that inspired. And Piper Kerman joins us today. Welcome back.
Hi, Ann. It's nice to be back.
You're associated largely with the women's prison system for obvious reasons, but you also know a lot about how the men's system operates. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what you know about how comparable they are now that you've waded into those waters?
Well, you know, obviously I was incarcerated myself. I served time in a federal prison. I was a first-time nonviolent drug offender like so many of the people whose sentences were commuted by former President Barack Obama. We have a huge carceral state in this country. We have the biggest prison population by far in the world. We incarcerate more of our own citizens than any society in human history has ever done. Women tend to be 6 to 7% of any correctional system, whether it's the state system, you know, the federal system. And so the vast majority of prisoners in this country are men. That is correct. Women have been the fastest growing part of the correctional system and of the prison system, though, and that's been true for decades. And I think that when you want to sort of try to understand the relationship between women's incarceration and men's incarceration, you know, we think about American harsh punishment, about sort of the philosophy that we see play out in the criminal justice system, which is so tethered to punishment. As opposed to rehabilitation, as opposed to using the criminal justice system to genuinely make the entire community safer. So if we think about the death penalty, you know, Ohio is a death penalty state. If we think about the practice of sentencing children to die in prison, juvenile life without parole. We're the only country in the world that really does that, the only sort of recognized government that does that. But when you think about women in the system, it's a much more ordinary and everyday example of harsh punishment because the vast majority of women that we send into the system are there for very low-level offenses. Two-thirds of incarcerated women are there for a property crime or a drug crime and not a violent crime, the crimes that most concern us. When you look at men in the system, men and boys in the system, as opposed to women and girls in the system, you do see a higher incidence of violence being related to the reason that they're incarcerated. But you still see a huge percentage of men and boys who go into the system, who enter the system for relatively low-level things. And once a person goes into the system, it's really hard to get out, right? Once you have served time and you've come back to the community, and the vast majority of people who we incarcerate are coming back to the community.
At some point or another, right?
Absolutely. Right. But when you have a felony conviction and you have been removed from the community for whatever period of time your sentence was, those two facts make it more difficult to return to the community successfully and safely. And that's why we see high recidivism rates. And we see high recidivism rates for both men and for women.
There's lots of other patterns as well. There's a really high percentage of both women and men who are victims of crime themselves, growing up or beforehand, at least.
I think, actually, that's the starting point for any discussion about our enormous prison population and about the criminal justice system and how we might do better. You know, I teach in two state prisons here in Ohio. I teach out at the Ohio Reformatory for Women in Marysville, and I teach at the Marion Correctional Institution up in Marion, which is a medium security men's prison. And it's incredibly rare that somebody victimizes another person who has not themselves been victimized at some point in their life as well. And that might have been during their childhood. That might have been the week prior. These things are very apparent and evident in the stories that my students choose to tell about their own lives. It's a nonfiction writing class that, that all those students are taking. And so whether you're talking about exposure to domestic violence, whether you're talking about being the victim of gun violence before you then turn around and commit a crime yourself, whether you're talking about sexual violence, whether you're talking about sexual assault or child abuse. You see those things play out overwhelmingly among women who are incarcerated, but you also see incredibly high numbers of that kind of victimization among men and boys in the system. And we have to ask ourselves a central question. If we do better for victims in the first place, we're going to have fewer crimes in the future. We're going to diminish those cycles of violence. I think one of the things that should sober everyone is that a person who's been victimized, a person who's been who's a survivor of crime, what's going to happen to them next really depends a great deal on socioeconomic status, on race. You know, someone who looks like me, a blonde, blue-eyed, upper-middle-class white woman, is going to have a better prospect at getting the restoration and the healing that I need if I am victimized by a crime than somebody, than a teenage boy who lives in a poor neighborhood that might be a poor neighborhood of color. Mm-hmm. The services and the recognition of the humanity and the needs of victims of crime are just like everything else in our society, not equal and not balanced and not evenly distributed.
There's those external resources that you just talked about, and then there's internal resources that are also affected by victimization. But things like literacy rates are ridiculously
mm-hmm.
low.
Mm-hmm. They are. What you see is that the majority of people who are incarcerated lack even a high school diploma. You see high incidences of learning disabilities like dyslexia among the incarcerated population.
Undiagnosed
often and untreated and unmet, and often, again, from a very young age. So really taking seriously the fact that we need more equity and parity when it comes to addressing things like learning disability, things like educational gap, things like mental health issues and substance abuse issues. The communities that need those things the most are the least likely to get them. And the chickens come home to roost in the criminal justice system.
Former Attorney General, I've got to switch all my names over now since we're switching administrations. But Loretta Lynch was a big part of the reforms at the federal level. Last November, one of the things the federal prison system did was launch a school district inside a federal prison system and a federal prison in Danbury, which is where you were at in Connecticut. It created a mental health facility for women. Two big things that go to that internal struggles that people have. If you can't read, if you're mentally ill, if you're suffering from depression, that sort of a thing. I'm wondering about that idea of a school district and turning prisons into schools.
Well, if you look at the criminal justice system, what you see immediately is that an educational deficit is the huge predictor of somebody going into the system. Mm-hmm. So whether you're talking about an individual who leaves, the formal school system early, drops out in middle school, drops out in high school, that kid's chances of going into the criminal justice system just skyrocketed because they've left school. So as a community, all our efforts should be at making sure that the kids who struggle the most with learning actually are the ones that we work the hardest to retain. But you also see if you broaden the lens and look at communities that where you see, educational deficit, again, that's where you see an incredible over-reliance on the criminal justice system down the road. So we have a moral responsibility to make sure that the people who we failed to serve when they were kids get some opportunity at learning what they need to know, whether that's basic literacy or whether that's a shot at higher education. And higher education in prisons was basically decimated when they eliminated Pell Grants. The Obama administration just launched a pilot to try to reinstate those Pell Grants. We'll see how that goes. But what we know for a fact is that access to education and particularly higher ed is an incredible antidote to recidivism. People who get those opportunities, and particularly those higher ed opportunities, people who are able to progress to higher education, almost never go back to prison. And so we all have a stake in that because it's so costly to taxpayers to incarcerate people. We have an incredibly expensive criminal justice system that is not very efficient or effective. And so really taking a look at what we know works. One of the things that holds us back from reform in this country is not that knowing what works. Like sometimes we have a clear sense of what works, mm-hmm. but there's such resistance to implementing those reforms because of our attachment to punishment, right?
Yeah. I'm talking with Piper Kerman, author of Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison, obviously the inspiration for the award-winning Netflix series Orange is the New Black. Piper will address America's criminal justice system and her own experience this week on the Ohio State campus. The event is free and open to the public. You can check out a link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Right. Our resistance to changes in our attachment to punishment. What have you learned about the punishment? Because I have to imagine when we go back like to the 80s to the 80s when this huge surge in reforms related, of course, to the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. I should say reforms. At the time, they were considered changes. Reforms, mm-hmm. changes associated with the war on drugs went into effect. And a lot of those people aren't even alive anymore. How did they gin up that passion for punishment?
Well, this brings us to that question of equity and who gets punished and who doesn't, right? Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, the phenomenal new documentary, The 13th, which was nominated for an Oscar today. These are some examples of work that has drawn our attention to the fact that the criminal justice system serves not only the purpose that we expect it to of making us all safe, making communities safe, but it has served other and less noble purposes over the course of time. So if we think about the history of this country, there was a time when slavery was the law of the land, and the criminal justice system was used to enforce that law. And after emancipation, very quickly Jim Crow laws were put in place to maintain that racial hierarchy, which was so economically important and also socially important in this country. And the criminal justice system was used to enforce Jim Crow laws. And we've come a long way since, the Civil Rights Act was put in place, since the Voting Rights Act was put in place, though, of course, that progress is under attack in this country still. But it's important to acknowledge that the criminal justice system has been really entwined in maintaining racial hierarchy, and that sort of makes sense when you think about an authoritarian, hierarchical, approach to something like making us safe, as opposed to a rehabilitative approach to making us safe. So when you talk about why is American justice so connected to harsh punishment, I think it really has a great deal to do with the fact that we have been tolerant of harsh punishment for some people in our society, going back through our entire history as a nation.
We're talking about the criminal justice system, criminal justice reforms, a la the prison system, the busiest prison system in the history of the world. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. Between 1980 and 2015, the number of inmates in U.S. prisons quadrupled. That's starting to downtick a little bit, but Ohio's prisons are chock full even as we speak. That's what we're talking about today. My guest is Piper Kerman. She's author of The Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison. If you have a question or comment for Piper Kerman, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Justice Department in late November unveiled a sweeping reset for inmates in the federal prison system, creating what it called a school district for inmates. In this new paradigm, every inmate would receive a birth certificate and state ID card paid for by the prison system, and new standards were set for privately run halfway houses. But the future of those reforms is unclear at the start of the Trump era in the Oval Office. Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions has not embraced prison reforms in the past. We'll find out how he feels about them if he's indeed confirmed, which he's expected to be, and becomes attorney general. We're talking about where and why reforms matter today with someone who has been on the inside looking out. Piper Kerman is the author of the memoir Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Woman's Prison, which inspired the hit Netflix series Orange is the New Black. She now teaches writing in Ohio prisons in Marion and also Marysville and is writing another book about those experiences. She joins us today. Piper, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here, Ann.
Gosh, there's so much to talk about. Let's talk about just those simple reforms that are going to cost money if they're instituted and retained, and that is a birth certificate and a state ID card. Now, obviously, once again, that wasn't an issue for you when you were in prison. When you got out, you knew that one way or another you'd get that kind of thing. It's really a minor thing to a lot of people.
It's a huge stumbling block to folks, particularly if you've been incarcerated for a long time. You might come out of prison. You may or may not have any place to go. So you might be heading directly to a homeless shelter. There were definitely women I was incarcerated with who we would talk about what was going to happen when we got out. And some of those women that I knew really well were headed straight to a homeless shelter. They knew that. And so if you start to think about the compounding challenges, so if you have no photo ID, like, what do you do? How are you going to get a job? How are you going to, frankly, interact with the world, particularly if you are, you know, fresh out of prison and having to get things in order? So those very, very basic things also are a significant challenge if you're talking about somebody who is indigent, who is in a situation of being homeless, who may or may not have a lot of education. And so all of those seemingly very ordinary steps are suddenly these insurmountable mountains and really contribute, you know, those kinds of very basic small things can contribute to recidivism, whether it's somebody going through a minor probation or parole violation, like not showing up for an appointment, or, you know, the more serious things that concern us, like committing a new crime. But, you know, here in Ohio, you know, we see a huge number of people cycling in and out of the probation system for very, very minor violations, things like not keeping an appointment or, you know, other what is known as a technical violation. So it's small and ordinary reforms that can sometimes make a big difference. Here in Ohio, excitingly, was one of the first states that started to move sort of comprehensive legislative reform around the criminal justice system. I believe the package passed in 2011. And so that's fantastic because over the last decade or so, we've seen about 30 states move some kind of criminal justice system reform. And some of them have been very audacious and some of them have been very tentative. Unfortunately, here in Ohio, you know, we've now got more people in prison than when those reforms were passed. And it's not because the crime rate is going up. The crime rates have been going down for decades and continue to be at historic lows. There's a variety of reasons why Ohioans have not enjoyed all the benefits that people in other states have enjoyed. So when we look at other states, we look at New York, when we look at California, New Jersey, South Carolina, these are states that have made significant reforms and have seen big reductions in their state prison populations. New York, New Jersey, they've reduced their prison populations by as much as 23-24%. And the states that have reduced their prison populations the most have also enjoyed the biggest declines in crime.
Okay.
So that's sort of counter counterintuitive to folks sometimes. Because
we think we've been taught that if you let them out, they'll commit another crime.
Correct. But, you know, we've long passed any point where prisons were really making us safer. And many people would argue that the way that we handle prisons and corrections is actually making us less safe because of those long periods of time that people are out of the community, which make it very hard for people to return. Or because the conditions in some prisons are so terrible, so brutalizing, that people come out in worse shape than they went in. And again, we have to come back to that question. Almost everyone is coming back someday. Almost everyone is coming back to the community. Here in Ohio, there's a lot of people who are cycling through the state prison system for short periods of time, which is ultimately pretty counterproductive. And I think Gary Moore, who runs the prison department here, has been very vocal about the fact that, you know, if someone's not really a danger to the community, then there are much more sensible, effective, and cost-effective ways of holding that person accountable and also getting them on the right track. And those ways invariably mean keeping them in the community and not sending them into the state prison system.
I wonder, particularly with Ohio, and to what extent the addiction crisis, the opioid addiction crisis, is a factor in why Ohio hasn't been able to achieve a lot of the results that the other states have.
It's a huge factor, but truthfully, we see those problems with substance use disorder and addiction all over this country.
Yeah.
Every state that has achieved really significant reforms and really significant reductions of their state prison population has done things a little bit differently, but there are several through lines that are very consistent. So the states that have been most successful at reducing the state prison population safely are states that have changed statutes, and that generally means mandatory minimum drug sentencing.
Okay.
Here in Ohio, about 75% of the mandatory minimum statutes have to do with drugs, right? So if we think about like the volume of, you know, law books, 75% of Ohio mandatory minimums relate to drugs. So if we just start looking at those and seeing which ones are redundant, which ones are excessive, which ones are unnecessary, which ones are counterproductive, we'll start to see fewer commitments to the state prison and potentially more sensible approaches. So, you know, statute changes are a part of successful reform. If you're going to have those statute changes, you have to have alternatives in the community. So you need to have probation that works. You need to have diversion or alternatives to incarceration that work, that prosecutors and judges and the community can rely on to create change in people's lives. And so in New York, for example, that's really what we saw. We saw that the vast majority going into the state prison population were from New York City and the area around it. And when we got really good community-based programs in New York that DAs and judges knew that they could rely on, that's when we really saw that population come down. And the final thing that has been true for all successful reduction of prison populations is also parole reform. Mm-hmm. So that question of giving people incentives to participate in rehabilitation, to make sure that rehabilitation is provided in correctional settings, and making sure that, in fact, when someone has earned a chance to return to the community, that that chance is made good.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about prison reforms. They're out there. They're working better than, in some places than others. My guest is Piper Kerman, author of Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Woman's Prison. That's How You Know Her Best, from the Netflix series as well, inspired by the book. But she's also a prison reform activist and also teaches nonfiction writing in two prisons at Marion and also in Marysville. Robert in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome, Robert.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Hi, Robert.
Hi. So I'm an ex-offender myself, and I was incarcerated in Virginia, mm-hmm. where they have a program down there for where they want all the people that are incarcerated to get their GED. Since getting out, within 6 months, I've enrolled myself into a public public university here in Ohio, and I've received my bachelor's degree.
Fantastic.
And I'm still having issues securing employment. Mm-hmm. So this And I think part of recidivism is employment and giving former ex-offenders really good employment. But when HR is always sees the record and it's like, no. And to piggyback on everybody's getting out, 80 to 95% of everybody's getting out is going to be getting out. And that is the nonviolent offenders, the violent offenders, and even the sex offenders are going to be getting out. And society needs to open up and allow them to have a chance. So that way recidivism drops.
Yeah. I would say that the number one thing that I hear about from other people who, like me, have a felony conviction, and I get, you know, I get email, I meet people, you know, out in the world, employment and barriers to employment is the number one thing. I get emails from folks, you know, like Robert, who say, you know, I'm doing all the things I'm supposed to do. I've applied for hundreds and hundreds of jobs, and I can't catch a break. You know, I caught a break in that I had a friend who was the president of a company, and the week after I was released from prison, I started work because he gave me the second chance that every single person needs. You know, here in Columbus, we have, you know, a pretty amazing reentry community, including a number of businesses that either have recognized, you know, some of the importance and benefits of working with people who are formerly incarcerated, or even places like Hot Chicken Takeover, which, you know, was created as a social enterprise, not just delicious chicken, but also, you know, an incredible second chance for many people who are coming home from prisoner jail. You know, Ohio is a ban the box state in that you can apply for, I believe, state and county employment, mm-hmm. and they will not ask the question about a criminal record until they've chosen to make a job offer. And that's a great thing. That's a great, but we do need more private
businesses.
Because
it gives them then a chance to get to know you exactly. and really talk about what your qualifications are instead of
exactly. But that. We do need more private employers. Places like Hot Chicken Takeover or Butterball Farms in Michigan has actually been phenomenal about really evangelizing to other private employers about their experiences, giving people second chance, being a second chance employer, and actually what great employees those folks have been for them.
But so then my mind starts drifting back, then why? And mm-hmm. it all goes back to this overarching philosophy we have of punishment mm-hmm. over yeah. rehabilitation.
Right. And the truth is that particularly during the last several decades where we've increased our prison population so much, this question of sort of never really actually extending forgiveness is beginning to, frankly, bite us in the ass. You know, there's 70 million Americans with some kind of a criminal record. There's, you know, an estimated, I think, 8 million people who are under correctional control of some sort at this moment, you know, 2.3 million who are incarcerated. But then when you add in probation and parole, you know, you get a lot more people. And suddenly you realize that this is not a fringe issue. You know, this is an issue that disproportionately affects poor people and disproportionately affects poor people of color. But it really affects all of us. You know, when you have that many Americans who are saddled in some way or unable to move forward, even though they may have paid their debt to society, that creates a real problem.
You know, one of the things that's inspiring a lot of the reforms is cost savings.
Mm-hmm.
We can't afford this. Even if that's what you want, mm-hmm. you can't afford it.
We absolutely can't afford it. We can't afford it economically. You know, it's a huge cost, especially to state governments.
Fixed cost, something you can't.
It's a fixed cost, and in some cases, it's a growing cost. Again, states like, you know, New York, New Jersey, California, South Carolina are enjoying the benefits of having reduced those costs dramatically. But in many states, you know, state government is spending more money on incarceration than it is on their state college systems. And people can really see, people can perceive that that is not a smart way of investing public dollars. But it is hard to sort of turn the tide. Right. That said, we have seen so much progress in the last 10 years. We have really seen a change in philosophy and a change in rhetoric. It's a worrisome thing about the federal government situation because the last 8 years we have seen a really significant change in the way that our nation's highest leaders talk and think about these challenges, I'm a little worried we're going to go back. The truth of the matter is, though, I got a lot of questions during the presidential. Well, I got a lot of questions during the presidential election about, you know, who I thought would be the better candidate for these issues. Anyone who's concerned with issues around criminal justice and reform and, you know, fairness and justice, the elections people should be paying attention to are county level. They are elections for prosecutor. They are elections for judge. They are elections for sheriff. These are the players who actually have the biggest impact on what our criminal justice system looks like, on whether people will go to prison and who goes to prison. And so as significant as the federal government is in terms of a bully pulpit and in terms of some of the impact that federal policy may have, where the action really is at the state level and even more so at the county level if we want to see change. And so that should give people hope, because that means almost any of us as citizens can contribute to that kind of change, because, you know, you can have a big impact as an individual at the county level when you let, you know, elected officials know how you want things to be, or when you start to get involved, either with helping to prevent, you know, young people from going into the system in the first place, or with helping people come home successfully, or helping contribute to people's rehabilitation in some way.
We're talking about prison reforms in the recent past, and those going forward as we embark on a new administration at the federal level. But my guest, Piper Kerman's, just made the point that the local level is important as well, if not more important. She's the author of Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Woman's Prison. Of course, the inspiration for the hit Netflix series, Orange is the New Black. Piper Kerman will talk about the criminal justice system and her own experience this week on the Ohio State campus. The event is free and open to the public. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about prison reform issues with author and activist Piper Kerman. Her memoir, Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Woman's Prison, inspired the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning original series for Netflix. Piper Kerman, thanks again for being with us. Appreciate it.
Oh, I love being here, Ann.
And if anyone has a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You already mentioned which states are doing it right when it comes to prison reform policies, and you said that, you know, New York, South Carolina, California, you know, doing it right. Ohio's mm-hmm. done a lot of good things, but it's not seeing the sort of same sort of changes. Mm-hmm. Are there little things? You said that everyone's doing it a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything identifiable about what they're doing different, or does it really have to be structured a little bit differently in every state anyway?
I mean, I think every state has its own political realities. So, you know, when we look at Georgia, which is moving, you know, a lot of, you know, Governor Deal there has been very committed to criminal justice reform and quite vocal about it. You know, it's a political reality which is quite different than California. California has probably made the most audacious set of criminal justice reforms. And some of those, by the way, have been by ballot initiative rather than coming through the state legislature. So the electorate is literally going to the polls and saying, you know, we want to significantly change the way we deal with juveniles in the system, and we don't want to have them going directly into the adult system, which is catastrophically bad most of the time. We want to legalize marijuana. You know, we want to, you know, change the three strikes rules. You know, so California is probably the most comprehensive reform. New York is often held up as having been the sort of most scalpel-like in terms of being very, very intentional and gaining this great result of an almost 25% reduction in the state prison population. But every state has to do it a little differently based on the political realities that are going on. You know, Texas is working hard at trying to reduce their prison population as well, and they have. They had one of the highest incarceration rates in the country to start with. So, you know, it's a process for them.
Yeah.
You know, Ohio has a high incarceration rate, and it has the highest probation rate, I think, in the entire world.
Meaning its requirements after you're out of prison are the most...
It can be a part of your sentence, or it can be an alternative to incarceration, but there's
okay.
a huge number of Ohioans on probation, and it's done in a really inefficient way in Ohio. So there are, I believe, 180 probation offices, and each of them is under the control of a county judge or a group of county judges. It's a very poor system. So there's a lot of opportunity in Ohio for reforms, and that's one that will have to be unique to Ohio because that's a uniquely weird outlier situation, the situation with probation in Ohio, which would make a big difference because there's a huge 25% of new commitments to Ohio's state prison system are probation violations. So that's just an incredibly inefficient way of dealing with what is generally very, very low-level stuff, right? And that's the thing you have to know about what we're dealing with here in Ohio is that a huge number of people are still going into the state prison system at that low level, right? At that low level. And, you know, if you want to see evidence of that, go out to Marysville to the Ohio Reformatory for Women, where you are seeing just enormous numbers of women being sent to prison for very low-level offenses. And it rarely serves them or their families or their communities well because, frankly, it overstuffs the prison. There are overcapacity out there at ORW, and that makes it harder to deliver rehabilitative services mm-hmm. where they exist. And also, if a person is only incarcerated for under a year, what's going to happen in practical terms is that they're going to spend many months in reception, which is sort of this, you know, this holding pen, as it were. You don't get any sort of...
It's sort of an introduction to prison without all of the benefits.
Sort of. I mean, it's literally like a holding pen. In the federal system, we used to call it the bus stop. You'd be in the bus stop for a period of time before you would actually get your permanent bed assignment or get access to any kind of programs. And so out at ORW, there's a lot of women who are incarcerated for these very short period of times. County judges and prosecutors are handing down those sentences, harsh sentences for minor crimes often. And then those women go into the correctional system, and the correctional system is so overstuffed that there's actually no rehabilitative resources that are available for
them. And ironically,
and then they're back on the street.
Right. The shorter they're there, the less services they get. The longer they're there, that's a whole other story.
Those services and accountability, those are things that should be happening in the community. Mm-hmm. Those tend to be, you know, overwhelmingly, you know, substance abuse and addiction issues, very often mental health issues that are co-occurring, and, you know, all of the things that attend that. And, you know, when we look at women and girls in the system particularly, it's estimated that as high as 90% of women and girls in the systems have been the victims of domestic violence or sexual violence prior to their incarceration. And very often that victimization has never been addressed, whether it was in a woman's childhood or whether it was the week before she got arrested. So we can just do better. And, you know, it's an interesting question. You know, we have to do things like change statutes, right? Those mm-hmm. mandatory minimum sentences have to be reformed if we want to do better and have fewer people, you know, sucking, you know, resources out of schools and out of firehouses and out of local police stations and into state prison systems. But we also have to see behavior change around the people who run the criminal justice system. So one of the things that's not so well understood is that the power of prosecutors has really grown and grown and grown and been consolidated over decades. The drug laws that are so frequently pointed to as drivers of mass incarceration were actually on the books for a good 10 years before prosecutors really began to implement them in the 80s and particularly in the early 90s, which is when you know, the prison population just ballooned in this country. So making sure that prosecutors and judges particularly understand their jobs from the public's perspective and understand that the public wants them to do things differently is very important. You know, Crawford County is further north than Marion. And for a long time, Crawford County sent a very small number of women into the state prison system. And then they got a new judge. And suddenly that number, you know, ballooned, you know, from like 2 a year to like 62. It's not because they're having a crime wave in Crawford County, even though, you know, some of the issues that you've raised around substance abuse and addiction are very serious. Mm-hmm. It's that there's a person there who thinks differently about their job and isn't necessarily thinking that much about the impact of that of their decisions when they send somebody into the state prison system.
We've been talking a lot about the state system, about the federal system, and a part of that in both levels is the privately run prisons. And Jamie in Cincinnati, you wanted to talk about that. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. I want to talk about the private prison system and how much that money-making machine has to do with all the lobbying and the what I think is probably bribery. I can't say that. Mm. But all that goes on to make sure that prison population keeps coming because they can't operate a for-profit prison unless they got a bunch of people incarcerated in there.
And there's a really interesting piece of that, Piper Kerman, that you talk about quite a bit and is out there. It's an issue. And that public entities are incentivized to fill those prisons because if they fall below certain levels, their contracts with those private prison operators kick in and they pay penalties.
Yes. That's many state governments have signed contracts with private prison corporations, and there's really only three. So it's sort of an oligarchy or an oligopoly.
Yeah.
Many state governments have signed contracts that have 90% bed guarantees. So in other words, our governments are guaranteeing to private corporations that their prisons will be full, which is completely bananas. One of the things that I am most excited about the Netflix show, you know, and, you know,
we got into it last season, right?
Yeah. So, you know, this is something that we talked about going back to even the beginning of the process of creating the show. And for people to understand that people draw benefit from the status quo, right? And the most explicit way that people draw benefit is from companies like those private prison corporations or, you know, correctional healthcare corporations.
If someone's profiting...
Yes.
There's an issue there.
It makes it much harder also to create change, right? I would expand that. You know, there's different kinds of profit, right? There's the most literal profit. You know, a private prison corporation has a bottom line and their only real responsibility is to their shareholders and to their bottom line. And by the way, the day after, you know, the presidential election, the stocks of private prison corporations skyrocketed because those private prisons are going to be full. And I think that's one thing that we should be concerned about around the federal government. But there are other ways that people draw profit out of the system and out of the status quo as well. I mean, there's literal financial benefit, but there's also the benefit, you know, when you think about, like, why is it hard to get prosecutors to do things differently, even though lots of people want them to and though the data shows us that we can be safe in other ways. Part of it is because prosecutors derive a great deal of power from the status quo and that a more just criminal justice system will actually have a diminishment of prosecutorial power. And so some of the players in the existing system don't want to relinquish that power. And so when we think about, like, how do people draw benefit, you know, sometimes it's literal financial benefit. People are literally profiting off of human bondage. And sometimes there are other ways that people profit.
So when we talk about changing statutes regarding minimum mandatories and that kind of a thing, if we eliminated entire categories of what qualifies somebody to be tried and convicted and sent to a prison, that reduces the number of people that...
Right. For example, California, one of the recent reforms in California was that they took low-level felonies and made them misdemeanors, which means that, you know, people would not be incarcerated.
The prosecutor will never see them.
Right.
Okay. Interesting. Education. I remember back in the 90s, in the olden days, when I covered the Ohio General Assembly, I used to joke that everybody's running for sheriff. That was when the minimum mandatories went in, you know, were really ratcheted up. That's mm-hmm. when the three strikes and you're out were implemented. Mm-hmm. A lot of the reason why Ohio is where it is today is because of those laws, and they're trying to unwind them now. Mm-hmm. But they also referred to prisons as something like country clubs. That was the big thing back then, is these guys, mostly men, mm-hmm. go into prison and they get to lift weights, they get to watch television, they mm-hmm. get to smoke cigarettes, they get to, legally, they get to do this and that. It's just like a country club.
Mm.
And they eliminated a lot of those things.
Yeah. I mean, I don't spend a lot of my time hanging out in country clubs, but I have been to a couple, and I've been to many, many prisons and jails, and you'd be hard-pressed to find too many similarities.
But there's that attitude about it.
Sure. I mean, I think I'll offer an example. You know, the men's prison where I teach, it's a medium-security men's prison. It was built for 1,400 men, and there are 2,600 living there now. So on the most basic fundamental level, if you think about how overstuffed, how incredibly overcapacity our prisons and our jails are, that leads to its own, you know, particularly unique misery and danger. You know, an overcrowded facility is much more likely to be an unsafe facility. This men's prison actually is you know, has one of the lowest rates of violence in Ohio. But also it creates just an incredible degree of scarcity of rehabilitation, scarcity of food, scarcity of, you know, anything you can think of.
Space,
everything. And so it's I've never been to a country club like that.
Mm-hmm. And I know when I've been to Marion Correctional, I learned that there are a lot of fans of the show in Marion Correctional. So hey, you guys.
Yeah, actually,
thanks for
one of my
listening.
Students, I want to say hi to Dion because I bet he's listening. I know he's a big fan of the show.
So, but they're very limited in what they can even watch on television.
Sure.
That's why PBS is a big deal to them.
PBS is a big deal to them. There's a hunger for knowledge as well. I would say this, having been incarcerated, it is really hard for somebody who has not set foot in a prison or jail or for, you know, is lucky enough never to have had a friend or a loved one caught up in it to really understand how incredibly removed you are from the outside world and the degree to which prisons and jails are worlds unto themselves, and that every choice or almost every choice is taken away from a person who's incarcerated. And something like the control of information can be complete and total. And actually, there's no greater currency in prison or jail than currency of information, whether it's gossip or whether it's not sort of more fundamental knowledge.
Something pretty esoteric that's going on. The reason why I was in Marion Correctional was because of the TEDx Marion Correctional. It was mm-hmm. the first prison in the world yep. to have a TEDx event. Of course, the TED Talks event. You can Google that if you want, if you haven't heard of it yet. But the incredible level of humanization that brought to mm-hmm. the experience of being in a prison as a visitor, because mm-hmm. I had been before, but nothing like that.
Yeah, that's actually how I came to Ohio. I was invited to go and participate in one of those events at Marion, and they continue to have them. They just had one between Christmas and New Year's. And to me, they were really astounding in this. It's hard to imagine a less equal relationship than the relationship between a prisoner and a warden or a correctional officer or anybody who operates a prison. And that's by design, right? That's how those institutions are designed. They're supposed to be that hierarchical and authoritarian. And in those TED events, which have been widely copied by in many, many states around the country. People have come to Ohio from California, from New York, from Pennsylvania, from lots of different states and observed those events and tried to recreate them in yeah. other places. What's amazing is that that stage, as it were, where people get up and give those TED Talks and talk about the ideas and the stories that are important to them is incredibly equalizing. So a prisoner gets up and gives a talk. a person who works in the prison gets up and gives a talk, an outside guest gets up and gives a talk, and it reminds us that we all three of those people are equally human.
Piper Kerman, thanks as always for joining us. I always appreciate your time.
Oh, it's great to be here, and I always enjoy talking to you, Anne.
Piper Kerman is the author of Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison, of course, the inspiration for the hit Netflix series, still on. Piper will address the criminal justice system and her experience this week on the Ohio State campus. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. The event is free and open to the public at large. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.